So today's topic is on coevolutionary dynamics, which I think is one of the more fascinating aspects of animal behavior. So last week we talked about how William Paley observed that animals have many traits that represent adaptations to their environment. So he noticed that animals' eyes were really seemed to fit the sort of purpose that those eyes needed to perform. So if they needed to see in the dark, they were very large. If they needed to see in the day, they were smaller. And then this, along with a whole bunch of other stuff, suggested led Darwin to think about natural selection, in which variation within species that is heritable can drive differences in fitness, and that as a result of this competition, some variants are more successful and species become better adapted to their environment over generations. And the whole and we used the example. We looked at the example of Darwin's finches, where Peter and Rosemary Grant found that selection can act very, very fast. So even over just a single generation, they studied them on this little island in the Galapagos, and they found that in this sort of first finding, they found that when there was a big drought, there was selection for large bill size. When the medium grand finch was present alone on the island, so larger birds could get the richer seeds, because they were the larger seeds that were remaining that the small birds couldn't get. But in the second drought, about 20 years later, they found that the selection was reversed and selection was on smaller bill size, because what happened in the meantime is that a competing species turned up. So the large-billed ground finch, it turned up around here. And that ground finch was able to get the bigger seeds better than the medium ground finch. And so the only medium ground finch that survived were the ones with the smallest bills that were able to get the smallest seeds. And why this is interesting is because it shows that the same change in the environment, so a drought, can result in different impacts on the population as a function of the species that are present in that population. So in this case, there's only the medium ground finch, and that had there was positive selection, and in the presence of the large-billed ground finch, there was negative selection. So the sort of social environment or the presence of another species changed how evolution took place. We also talked a little bit about social selection and group level selection, where it's more fine scale differences. So you can think about this competitive exclusion about large bit of ground finch as being social selection, but that occurred that was measured across the whole population. You can also look at variation within a population and see how the differences in the social environment that every individual has affects its fitness. So in this case, we looked at great tits and the arrival date of great tits into a woodland, and individuals that arrived relatively later than their social environment had a lower territory success, or lower success in acquiring a territory, and individuals that arrived relatively earlier had a much higher success. Okay, so again, the sort of fitness of individual is not just determined by their own phenotype, which is their sort of the time which they arrive, which might be determined by their genes for dispersal, but also by the phenotype of others in their social environment. So this kind of leads to the idea of coevolutionary dynamics, where you kind of take out the pressure that comes from the environment, and all you're left with is the dynamics that occur between species. So one species has a behavior, and that behavior drives selection on another species. Okay, so typically in coevolution dynamics, most cases we look at antagonistic interactions. So, for example, some species are something that has a negative impact on the other species, causing selection for that species to respond. And then the process of this happening over time, and this is one of the things that's quite interesting about this, is that there is no optimal. So if you think about selection for an environment, there is maybe an optimal eye for an environment. Well, here there's often not an optimal eye, because the whole system, it's like the environment responds. And this is why we call it coevolution, because the evolution A drives evolution B, which then feeds back to evolution A. And we typically call these escalations of adaptations and counter-adaptations, which leads to what we say is an arms race. So it's called an arms race because, thinking about the Cold War, for example, you know, one country, the US, develops nuclear weapons, and so the Russia's developed nuclear weapons, and so the Americans develop even bigger ones, and the Russians even bigger ones, and no one ever basically wins. And so this has also been termed the Red Queen evolution. This is a symbol of the fact that a lot of evolutionary theories come from Oxford. Lewis Carroll was a tutor at Christchurch College in Oxford, and he wrote Looking Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland. And there's a scene in Alice in Wonderland where the Queen is pulling Alice along very, very fast through the environment, and Alice remarks that they're basically staying in the same place, and the Queen says, "Now here you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place." Okay, so this is the idea behind covolutionary dynamics, is that because evolutions are in response to counter-evolutions, basically they're evolving to remain with the status quo. And selection through coevolution happens strongest when there's a close ecological relationship between the species that are interacting. So for example, the classic one, which we'll talk about a bit today, is predators and prey. Right? Predators evolve to catch prey, and prey have to evolve to escape predators. You have the same with parasites and hosts in terms of virulence. Then we'll talk a little bit at the end about mutualisms. And of course, any competitor happens like this. So, for example, the example of the large ground finch and the medium ground finch was a competitive process. So the large ground finch outcompeted the medium ground finch on something, and the medium ground finch evolved to have smaller bills. This can also happen in terms of sexual conflict, and I'll talk about mating systems in 3 or 4 weeks' time, and there we'll cover a little bit about coevolution of gametes in the sex. And of course, what is interesting, and we'll touch on this lecture, is that coevolutionary dynamics can drive speciation, and this is why people get very excited about this. So as I mentioned, the idea behind coevolutionary dynamics is that you have some adaptation in a species, and that drives selection for some counter-adaptation in another species, which then feeds back to affect selection on that first species. And this is a cyclic process. It never ends. It's like the queen moving very fast with Alice. It never ends. The environment stays the same. Okay, so if we think about this in terms of predators and prey, we're going to go through some examples of this. So predators, basically you have selection for predators to improve the hunting success. Okay, hunting for a predator is very costly. It requires energy. There's risk that the predator will become injured. And ultimately, anything a predator can do to improve the probability that it catches a prey will be selected for. Of course, if any improvements in hunting success by predators is going to immediately feed into selection on prey. Okay, so prey will then evolve strategies to improve their defense or improve their ability to escape predators. Okay, so some of the ones we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about in terms of predator adaptations, we can talk about ability, so the ability to catch, the switch into nocturnal hunting, visual acuity, so this relates back to Paley's eyes, and hunting strategies, and these have a whole bunch of different responses. We can also look at adaptations by the prey, such as toxicity, again, nocturnal foraging, the opposite to that, aposematism, so which is a signaling strategy, and other predator avoidance strategies. Okay, so agility, of course, the one we're most familiar with is a leopard hunting, hunting Thompson's gazelle. And these two species are in an arms race for agility and speed. Okay, so cheetahs are thought to be one of the fastest animals on the planet, and the reason they're so fast is because these guys are really difficult to catch. Okay, so every time that the cheetah got a little bit faster, these gazelles have developed some way of counter-adapting that. But actually, that's not the end of the story. The whole dynamics of the system is not driven ultimately by the cheetah's ability to run fast. This is where it gets a little bit interesting. So if you look at the speed at which cheetahs have been observed to hunt and be successful, it's sort of what we would expect is that if it was only about speed, we'd expect that the most likelihood of a cheetah being successful is when it ran really, really fast. Okay, but instead we observe that some kind of intermediate speed is more likely to be successful. And if we look at the unsuccessful hunts, there's no sort of difference in those distributions. So it's not cases where they ran faster, they were able to be successful. So why might this happen? Why would it be that cheetahs are sort of so well known to be such fast hunters, and yet when you look at the probability of being successful in a hunt, speed doesn't seem to have anything to do with it? So to understand this, and remember last week we talked about Tim Bergen's four questions, and one of the questions was mechanisms. And to understand this, the dynamics of this system, we need to dig in to the mechanisms and the mechanistic aspects of how speed and movement and agility trade off against each other. And so what happens, basically the answer to this solution is that if you run really fast, then the angle at which you can turn is much larger. Is smaller, so the arc in which you can turn is much larger. So if you run really fast, you basically, every time you turn, you create centrifugal force that's pushing you outwards, and that force, if you go faster, is stronger, which means that you can't turn as tightly. And what happens between a cheetah and a prey, antelope, is that, say you have a hunt that starts like this, the cheetah will run towards the antelope, the antelope will respond by running ahead, and of course a cheetah is faster than the antelope, so it'll run, it'll catch up to it, and just as it's about to catch the antelope will turn, okay? It'll make a very sharp turn. As it makes this very sharp turn, the cheetah overshoots the position of the antelope and ends up being further away again from the antelope. So if we look at the distance between them, this is maybe where the hunt started, so the cheetah was detected about 20 meters away, gets very close, and when it's within a couple of meters, the antelope turns and the distance grows again. Okay, so up here now, we're at this sort of point here where there's a large distance between them, and the cheetah now is having to catch up again to the antelope. And as it catches up, because it's faster, gets very close, and then suddenly the antelope turns again a very sharp corner, and the cheetah overshoots that corner. So the important thing here is that the antelope strategy for avoiding cheetahs is not to try and outrun the cheetah, but to try and outmaneuver. It's basically putting the cheetah's speed against it. Okay, antelope can't outrun a cheetah. It can't evolve to run that fast because, of course, it's carrying a lot of mass. It's very top heavy, and so on. And so what they've developed are these sort of really tight cornering strategies. So you can see that here. So this is a point which a cheetah is almost catching the antelope, and the antelope does this almost 90-degree turn. Okay, and so that has limited the value of the cheetah evolving a faster hunting speed. Okay, so we think about hunting agility. Predators, so cheetahs, have evolved to run really fast, but the outcome of this is that the prey have evolved some kind of evasion tactics, which is to make tighter turns. And one of the really important things here, and this is something that there's some interesting videos on YouTube if you want to watch, when, for example, biologists go and study antelope, they often sort of chase them down with helicopters, and they'll come up, and the idea is to dart to tranquilize the antelope so that they can maybe put a GPS collar or something on it. And so as they come up with a helicopter, the antelope is running in straight line, and as the helicopter comes almost over the top of the antelope will make a really tight turn. So the whole process, this only works because the antelope is making the cornering almost at the last moment, just as the cheetah is getting really close to it. And if it didn't do that, then the cheetah could sort of start turning, you know, at a location before where the antelope turns, and therefore that distance between them would not ever get quite so large. Okay, so that's the sort of the key critical aspect there. Of course, many species have evolved in response to predation. They've evolved to be active at night. So, for example, many rodents and small mammals are active at night because during the day they're so easy to catch. Right? They're having to look for food and a whole bunch of other stuff, and a predator can just sit in a tree and see a rodent down there and come and catch it. And so rodents have evolved to become nocturnal. So in response to this adaptation, a whole bunch of predators have also evolved to be nocturnal. And in doing so, they've also evolved a whole bunch of other traits that allow them to be more successful as nocturnal hunters. So owls, of course, are the ones we know best, mainly because there's so many YouTube videos of cute owls doing silly things. But owls have become basically specialist predators, avian predators, to hunt at night. And some of the features that they've had, of course, because hunting at night is very difficult because you can't necessarily see where your prey is because there's hardly any light. And of course, nocturnal animals often don't feed when there's a full moon, because when there's a full moon, it's almost like being in a day. So they feed when in the dark of the night when there is no moon. So one of the adaptations that owls have developed is to have asymmetric ears. Yes, if you sort of take all the feathers for an owl, what you'll find is that one ear will be sort of relatively high up, like up here, and the other ear will be down lower. And what this does is it creates a difference in the time it takes for sound to reach the two ears. And in doing that, they can calculate the direction that the sound is coming from. Okay, so by turning their head, and you notice also that owls often have these kind of moon faces like this. And this is all about getting the sound and catching the sound like a parabola. Okay, so they catch the sound onto their face, and it goes into their ears in a sort of really true way, without distorting, without bouncing the sound. And by calculating a difference, so when they turn their ears, they can calculate when it reaches one ear versus the other, and they can pinpoint the direction that it's in. Must be really interesting to hear as an owl. So another adaptation that they have is, of course, adaptations that allow them to get close to prey without the prey detecting them. Okay, so we know leopards and cheetahs and so on, they'll hunk down in the grass. That's their adaptation for avoiding being spotted. They will go as close in the grass, camouflage as close to the prey as they can, because the closer they are to the prey, the more likely they are to catch the prey. Owls have done a similar sort of thing, except that what they've done is they've developed basically silent feathers. So if you look at the feathers of an owl, I have an owl wing at home. I should have brought it. I forgot. But it's full of these little tiny little barbs. Okay. If you look at a normal bird, a daytime bird, like a parrot, for example, they make a lot of sound, a lot of noise when they fly. And have very sharp edges because that's more aerodynamic. It allows them to fly faster. This is really not aerodynamic, but what it does is it completely dampens the sound. It's like pulling sort of a big fluffy thing through the air. It doesn't make as much sound as if you pull a piece of cardboard through the air. Right? If you wave cardboard, it's loud. If you wave like a fluffy jumper or something, it's not loud at all. Okay? Because there are no edges to sort of make these little whistling noises. So their entire body, and especially their wings, are covered in these feathers that have what they call little barbules. Okay? And basically it means that when an owl flies, it's completely silent. And if any of you have been lucky to go and observe owls in the forest at night, it's quite scary, spooky sometimes, because all you'll hear is when they land on a branch, you hear it as their big talons sort of land on the tree, and you never have any idea of where they're flying. And sometimes they're quite big, some of these really big owls, and they're completely silent. Okay, so many small mammals feed at night, and of course that opens a niche for predators, and a whole bunch of predators have evolved adaptations to allow them to successfully hunt their prey at night. Okay, bats are another example, and bats follow moths, which are sort of large, ungainly flying creatures. And so they haven't really worked, they haven't sort of gone down the strategy of stealth so much. Their adaptations, their interesting adaptations, are in terms of their ability to locate and isolate the presence of a moth. And the way they've done this, of course, is through echolocation. So they have a small organ that emits sounds, very high frequency sounds, and these sounds bounce off, just like a sonar, or if you have a boat or anything like that. They bounce off the objects, and they come back, and they catch them with their huge, big ears. And in doing that, by looking at the sort of timing between the point where the sound is left and it's come back, they can identify the distance and location of where their prey are. Well, it's interesting, and again, this lecture is about coevolution, so in having this sort of echolocation means that bats are much better at catching moths than if they didn't have echolocation. And so this creates more stronger selection on the moth to be able to evade predators. And actually, there is recent evidence that suggests that moths can do so. And they do so by simply listening for the presence of a bat. Okay, so much as herbivores, for example, look for try and detect a predator, a leopard or a cheetah hiding in the grass, moths are listening for an incoming bat. So this is a time sequence. So they sort of took a bunch of pictures. Each number here is one flash of a picture. So in the first picture, the moth was here. The bat was somewhere over there. It's only in the third picture that the bat is coming very fast. You can see it's flying much faster than the bat. The bat is flying faster than the moth. The moth has only traveled this distance. By the fourth picture, the moth is in here, and the bat is over here. It's getting much closer. And by the fifth picture, you can see that the moth has actually made quite a large evading maneuver. It's dropped right down, and in the sixth picture, it's dropped right down. And what happens here is, again, you have this turning circle thing, and then the bat wasn't able to turn fast enough, and the bat overshot the location of the moth. Okay, so the moth can also detect how far away the bat is, because when bats hunt, initially they use fairly low frequency signals, so sparse signals, because that gives them better information about distance. It travels further, but as they approach, they get faster and faster, and when they get very close, they emit signals very, very fast, because they're getting the bounces off the prey very, very fast. Okay, so it gives them high temporal resolution. So the moths are listening for this, and when they have some kind of threshold in which when the frequency of the bat sonar that is being emitted is really high, then they make this evasive maneuver, which is basically they just let go of their, close their wings and drop down towards the ground. Can anyone see the animal here? This is a dragon. You can see the tail of the dragon. This is the tail, the body of the dragon, the head. Yeah, so one really fascinating adaptation, of course, is camouflage. Okay, so predators, again, I said that predators evolve to maximize the probability of hunting prey. So prey can adapt to that by either becoming very difficult to catch, or alternatively, they can adapt ways of becoming very difficult to find in the first place so that the predators can't spot them. And this is what camouflage is all about. There are different kinds of camouflage. So this is, I can't remember the names of them, but this is basically where you become invisible. There are other kinds of camouflage where you masquerade as something else. So this looks like a bird dropping, but in fact, it's a moth. And if you look at moths, you get all these amazing different types of moths, some that look like the end of a stick, some that look like bird droppings, some that look like spiders, for example. Really, really crazy mimicry. Okay, predators, of course, also don't want to be spotted either, because if the prey spot the predator, then they become more alert. They watch it, they know where it is, and so on. So owls, for example, are classically very well camouflaged. So this is an owl sitting in its hollow. Of course, this owl also could be camouflaged to avoid other predators. So many of the owls are mesopredators. So during the day, these guys can be killed by larger predators, so by falcons and hawks and things. And so they're also hiding out from those predators. So there is some really interesting experimental work that's been done to look at the evolution of camouflage. And one really neat study is a study where they looked at blue jays hunting moths. Okay, so they provided moths on two different kinds of background, on a conspicuous background, so just like a plain black background, and on a cryptic background. And of course, you can see the ability of a blue jay to detect the moth on the conspicuous background is over 80%, but less than about 10% when it's on a cryptic background. They took this a little bit further. These authors took this a little bit further actually about 20 years later. And they did, they used computers to simulate evolving moths. Okay, so they had the blue jay as the predator. So blue jays pecking at screens and getting rewards when they pecked at a predator, at a correct prey. And then as a result of that, that created selection on their artificial moths, and they let those moths evolve. Okay, so they started with parental populations of moths. So this is the parental population on a conspicuous background, and this is on a cryptic background. So you can see that you can still see what a moth is. And then they created a whole bunch of experiments. So one experiment was that they had 100 generations where they didn't allow the moths to select, they just allowed them to have genetic drift, so they didn't change randomly. And you can see in most cases, you can still see all of the moths quite easily, so it's quite easy for the predators to still pick them up. They also had, of course, the main experiment, which is to create selection. So the moths that were more obvious, so for example, this one is maybe pretty obvious, and this one's a little bit less obvious. And so if a jay pecked at this moth, they then allowed this moth to reproduce and transmit its traits with some mutation to the next generation. And what you get here is you're starting to get a whole bunch of moths that are more difficult to see. So some are still really obvious, but others, maybe this one, and this one down here, are much more difficult to spot. Okay. They also did a bunch of experiments where they had frequency, so rarer types of moths were more difficult to spot, and they found that this also evolved some difficult to spot moths. But actually the most important thing that they found is that this also created different lineages of moths, and it created much higher variation in the phenotypes of moths over generations. So it produced moths on which selection could act more strongly and ultimately might turn into different species. Okay, so that was, so I should have mentioned at the start that one of the main adaptations of many prey, if you look at any prey animal, they have huge eyes. Okay, they have very high visual acuity. Now, eagles, for example, can see something, I don't know, tens of times better than what we can. They have really high resolution. They can spot really small prey from a very long distance away. As a result of their increased spotting ability, the prey have evolved ways of becoming more difficult to identify. Okay, a moth that looks like a bird dropping is still easy to see, but it's maybe more difficult to identify that as a moth as opposed to a bird dropping. The other one, another sort of adaptation that many prey have is, of course, to develop some kind of armor, okay, to make them maybe not less obvious, but even if they are spotted, to make it very costly for the predator to hunt them. Okay, so this is porcupine, an African porcupine, and a leopard. And this is a footage, you can go on YouTube and look at the videos of this. This leopard must have been very hungry because it decided that it wanted to make a meal out of this porcupine. Over a whole series of minutes, this predator, every time it tries to get at the porcupine, the porcupine sort of turns its back to it and exposes its spines to it. And eventually, the leopard does get at the porcupine. It kills the porcupine by getting in underneath it. But the cost that it has incurred in doing this is that it becomes completely covered in spines. And I believe that by the end of this leopard actually died of the injuries. Okay, so in this case, this is an important thing to do with selection. In this case, even though the porcupine still died, the fact that that predator has died means that any genes that made this leopard more likely to kill a porcupine have gone extinct along with it. There is, when I was doing research for this lecture, I did find this interesting example from our own backyards, which I don't know if this has ever been replicated, but these hedgehogs, apparently, the story goes that hedgehogs will attack toads, so the common toads, these sort of warty frogs that we have in the forest around here, and the toad secretes toxins which react with the hedgehog, of course, because it's toxic to the hedgehog, and makes the hedgehog foam at the mouth, and then the hedgehog tries not to ingest that, but instead it sort of spits out the foam onto its spines in order to try and make its spines toxic. So this is a kind of an interesting thing that the hedgehog has developed some kind of adaptation of being spiky as well, but it's not necessarily the most effective because they're much smaller spikes relative to a porcupine, for example. And it's kind of tried to make that even more pronounced by making some kind of little toxic spines on its back. In many species, of course, they develop armor by just their sheer body size and body power and robustness. So elephants, for example, are very difficult for most species to hunt. Same with buffalo and many of the cattle. And these are muskox that live up in the Arctic. And they're super interesting because, firstly, they have these incredibly solid heads. But actually, this is not for defense so much. This is for sexual selection. So this is because the males compete for females and they butt each other in the head like goats and so on do. But their strategy for defending their young when there's a polar bear around is that the adults will form a sort of corral, a circle around the young and protect them so that the polar bear can't get in to attack the juveniles. And of course, it's a little bit too costly for a polar bear to attack an adult. Okay, so predators have developed a whole bunch of different hunting skills and make them more efficient hunters, but prey have developed weaponry and deflection and defenses. Okay, so I didn't talk about herbivores, but of course many, almost all plants are subject to predation by herbivores, and many plants developed, that should be thorns, not horns. Oh, sorry, actually herbivores develop horns, plants develop thorns. Small mammals develop spines, for example, like the hedgehog, and groups also can develop cooperative defense of their young. Okay, now if you look in nature, actually, what you kind of often see is that animals are not that difficult to spot. Okay, there's a whole bunch of animals that are so obvious. You go, you know, how is anything not eating you? Okay, so really bright caterpillars, sort of these pufferfish that are really colorful and so on, and also swim very poorly. Really bright plants, and so on. Now, what this is actually an alternative prey strategy, which is to develop signaling, okay, to signal to the predator that I'm no good for eating. Okay, so the way that they're not good for eating typically is that they're toxic for the predator. So newts, which are kind of like salamanders, are highly, highly toxic. Okay, I think one of these newts has enough toxicity to kill 25,000 white mice. Okay, why would it need to be so toxic? So the hypothesis here is that nukes have become so toxic because there's some kind of escalation, in the sense that when they were a little bit toxic, the predators developed adaptations to mean that they weren't susceptible to those toxins. Okay, and so as soon as a predator is no longer susceptible, it doesn't pay for this newt to be toxic, and so they become more toxic again, and so on. And this escalates more and more and more. Okay, so the garter snakes here, a North American species, have evolved resistance to the toxin of these newts. So this is kind of an escalation just in the amount of toxicity and resistance that they have. So throughout this lecture, I'm going to talk about different ways that we can look at, we can identify signatures of coevolution. And the first method is to study the spatial variation in the relationship between two species. So for the case of the newt and the salamander, the newt and the garter snake, sorry, we can look at whether there's spatial variation in toxicity in the newt and in resistance by the garter snake. And this is what Edmund Brody did, same guy who found the hedgehogs eating toads. And Edmund Brody went and looked at lots of different places, at lots of different populations, and he found that there's a very clear relationship between the toxicity of the newt and the resistance of the snake. Okay, so newts varied in toxicity, and in the places where they're very toxic, the snakes had very high resistance. In the place where they're not very toxic, the snakes had very low resistance. Okay, so this is a pretty nice suggestion that there's sort of coevolution. So that as a newt becomes more toxic, you get evolution of the snake to become more resistant. Okay, they did this. They also looked at this spatially, and they found that there's like a mosaic of toxicity and resistance in the population. And then they found areas that are outside where newts exist, but the snakes where snakes exist, but the newts don't exist, and these snakes have no resistance whatsoever. Okay, so the spatial distribution and the coexistence of newts and snakes tell us about the likelihood that there's coevolution happening here. And they further they found that there seems to be two hot spots of snake resistance, and so it suggests that maybe the toxicity in the newts evolved in two separate places. Okay, so across the animal kingdom, we find these very, very brightly colored animals that are basically signaling to predators to say, you know, I am not available as a prey because if you eat me, then you will feel very ill at best. Predators seem to learn to avoid these prey. So there's a bunch of work done by Joanna Mapes at the University of Helsinki over the last 20 years and shows that in this situation here, what you have a single prey and a predator. And the first time the predator encounters the prey, so here we have the bright prey item, so like a red prey item that is also toxic. We have a cryptic prey item that just looks like all the other ones that's toxic, and a completely edible prey item that looks like this one. And so in the first trial, in the first encounter, of course, the predator has no information about that prey, so it's just as likely to eat all of them. But after just that one trial, if it encounters one of these toxic prey, it learns very quickly that that signal means I'm going to be sick, and then it avoids, well, the second trial is already avoiding eating that prey. Okay, so this is important because it suggests that it can evolve very, very quickly. Okay, so just one toxic prey that evolves to be a little bit more red, for example, could be picked up by predators very, very quickly as toxic prey. Now, what's interesting, of course, is if you have this really strong signal, for example, red things are bad, then predators stop eating red things, then, of course, you can basically provide an environment where it's beneficial for other things that maybe are not toxic to also be red. Okay, so for example, we find in a whole bunch of common garden plants that are sort of these red and yellow, and these are toxic, so the animals know not to go to them. But then you get a whole bunch of other ones that are not toxic that also evolve this. Similar with these coral snakes, you get the coral snake, which is very, very deadly, and then you get the false coral snake, which looks very similar, but is harmless. And of course, there's some suggestion that they have to look a little bit different because they also have to recognize each other so that they can successfully mate. Now, this is what they call Bayesian mimicry, which is basically you mimic something that is bad so that in order to increase your own survival. But of course, this only pays if you're relatively rare in the population. Okay, so if if the vast majority of things that are red are toxic, then predators will go and every time they try something red, you know, just because they want to try, they're going to get this negative this negative experience, and they're going to avoid red things. But if the mimics, if the things that are not toxic are really common, okay, so the probability that a predator that tries something red is going to get a mimic that is not toxic, then that predator is going to say, okay, well, maybe this is not such a good cue, okay, and maybe it's going to learn to start foraging on red things. Okay, so of course this is dependent a little bit on how toxic the red thing is versus not toxic, but there's a whole dynamic system of what we call sort of an evolutionary game, in the sense that the more toxic something is, the more costly it is to be toxic, and it only pays for it to be red, for example, if it's very common, okay, if the signal is as true a signal as possible. Okay, so you get all these dynamics. The sort of take-home message is that the mimic, if it's basically, if every individual in the population is a mimic, then predators are just, there's no point in them avoiding red prey items. Okay, so toxic, in mimicry, toxic species make themselves obvious, basically as a signal to the predators, and the other species can copy this. Of course, then predators can counter-adapt, they can learn to recognize different type of prey. They can also sort of trade off things. If something is toxic but not deadly, you know, maybe it pays to feed on some red items because most of the time or enough times I get something that is not going to be toxic. In a couple weeks' time, we'll talk about group living, and group living, of course, is one major adaptation that we see in the animal kingdom to avoid predation. For example, this is a flock of starlings. Okay, there's maybe 10,000 starlings in here, and these are likely to have come together to form these murmurations as a way of avoiding being attacked by predators. Or not avoiding being attacked, but avoiding a predator being successful through the confusion effect, which I talked briefly about last week, but we'll talk more in a couple of weeks. Okay, but predator prey dynamics can also be in a behavioral arms race. Okay, so flocking, for example, is a co-adaptation of prey. Vigilance, alarm calling, for example, is a prey response that when they spot a predator, they can alarm call. So that makes the success rate of the predator be reduced, okay, because all the prey are getting information that a predator is coming very early on, so they can hide in the bush and so on. And that, of course, drives evolution of more stealthiness by the predator. And other things, so for example, mobbing, in order to sort of signal to the predator that we know where you are, so you should go somewhere else to hunt. And one really nice way of, one really nice example of co-evolutionary dynamics between predators and prey is from the UK in the 1960s and 1970s. So many of you might know that in the 1950s, of course, people had widespread use of DDT. It had been invented in World War II as a pesticide, and people were using this on their crops. And a bunch of scientists, including Rachel Carson, sort of noted that this was causing the disappearance of many top predators. And the key ones were avian raptors. And what happened is that DDT was causing the eggshells of the raptors to become really thin, and then those eggs were no longer good environment for the chicks, and all of the nests failed. And so what happened is that in the UK, the common sparrowhawk, which is the main predator of prey of small birds, went almost completely extinct. Okay, so down to sort of about 30% of the population of what it is now. One major adaptation by the prey items of these sparrowhawks, for example, this is a great tit, is to carry, many small birds carry fat in the winter because they have to survive the long nights. So, you know, as a night becomes longer and colder in the middle of winter, they carry this fat so that they can burn the fat overnight to keep themselves warm. Okay, so the way small birds survive is that they shiver all night. It makes their muscles work. You know how you go for a run, you get very hot. When your muscles are working, it creates heat. But this requires a lot of energy, and so they carry, they store fat all over their body in order to provide the energy source for them to survive overnight. But of course, being fatter makes you more vulnerable to predation. And so what they observed in some studies, for example, in Wharton Woods, which is the study system I spoke about last week, where I did my PhD, they found that when the sparrowhawks had disappeared, the birds became much fatter. Okay, there's no more cost of, or no more risk of being eaten by a sparrowhawk, and so they could put as much fat as they could possibly put on to help them survive overnight. Okay, so great tits became heavier when the sparrowhawk was absent. Okay, so this is sort of the tail end of the 40s and early 50s. This is the sort of mass, the average mass of the tits. And then when DDT started becoming more widely used and the sparrowhawks disappeared, they became much fatter all the way through into the 1970s when the sparrowhawks started returning, when DDT was banned. And as the hawks became more established, the amount of fat that they carried was back to the sort of starting levels. And they found that this only happened in areas where the sparrowhawks disappeared and then returned, as opposed to a few of the areas, like around here, where the sparrowhawks were always present. Okay, and a few places where they're always absent, there's no relationship there in the time. So this, in the study, they showed that the presence of this predator was basically selecting tits to carry less fat in order for the tits to be more agile in evading their prey, in evading their predators. One thing that's important is to think about all of this as the fact that it occurs in what we call food webs. Okay, all of the pieces of this system are all interconnected. So when a predator evolves a strategy that makes it more successful for prey, it might reduce the number of prey items, but these prey items are also predators on smaller insects and so on, so that it changes the selection and all the way through into the primary producers. And this is a whole very large area of research which I call community ecology. There are some really nice examples of this, what they call trophic cascades, where the change in the presence or absence of a predator has downstream effect through the whole ecosystem. Okay, so this is in Yellowstone in the US, and in 1995 they reintroduced the first pack of wolves back into Yellowstone after they'd been absent for 70 years. Okay. During those 70 years, these elk became very, very abundant, and they started eating all of the habitat out, eating all of the grass, eating all of the saplings. And what happened was that most of the environment, I don't know if you can see this, was basically almost bare ground with large mature trees. There were almost no new trees growing because the elk were going and eating all of the saplings. Okay, so it looked something like this, open grassland, a few dead trees and a few live trees remaining. About 10 years after they arrived, you can start seeing a bit of a change in the habitat. You get these tufts of grass and so on, and then you get a whole secondary succession about another 10 years later. And this is the sort of change in the densities of different species. So wolves, when they're introduced, they start increasing. Elk start decreasing. And not only did elk start decrease in number, so they're changing the absolute amount of pressure that they're putting on the primary environment, but they're also changing their behavior. They were not foraging so much out in the open. They were hiding more in the trees, which is what allows this shrubbery to grow out in these open areas. All of this affected the tree population, so the tree populations grew. They grew in size, they grew in the number of stems, but this also then fed into the number of beavers that were present, for example, because there's now more trees for the beavers to of the right size, more sort of logs that are beaver size, so the beavers became more successful. And the bison, who are not being hunted by wolves, they were released from competition from the elk, and so they increased in number as well. Okay, so just the presence or absence of one species completely changes the whole ecosystem through sort of behavioral dynamics of the species involved. Okay, another area, so we talked a lot about predators and prey. I'll talk briefly about hosts and parasites. Hey, parasites, basically, the idea behind a parasite is that they seek to optimize their transmission into new hosts. Okay, so they reproduce and they want their offspring to go into some new hosts. Hosts, of course, seek to optimize their own reproduction and the resistance to those parasites. And so you get some sort of trade-offs in the sense that parasites trade off being more virulent, so being more deadly. If they're deadly, then the host disappears and they can't transmit to a new host, versus being more easy to transmit, and host trade off their reproduction with their resistance. Of course, because everything is costly for animals to do. So the question is, why are not all parasites deadly? Well, the reason is because if they become too deadly, then their host basically goes extinct. They drive their host to extinction. Okay, so if they become very virulent, very deadly, then the host mostly die, so they disappear from the environment, which makes it more difficult for the parasite to transmit into a new host. Okay, so the transmission decreases, but once as a result, the selection for the parasite to become less virulent, and as soon as it becomes less virulent, the number of hosts can increase very rapidly because they're no longer being killed off by this parasite. And once they become very common, then that increases selection for the parasite to become virulent, and you get these, what they call these spiraling dynamics between host, parasite, virulence, and abundance. Okay, so one example of this, this comes from Australia, where I come from. And in the 1860s, the British, in their infinite wisdom, introduced a whole bunch of species into Australia, including the fox, but also the rabbit. It turns out that Australia is really, really good habitat for rabbits. Okay, and rabbits just became in absolute plague numbers. I mean, this is just a waterhole somewhere. This is some pelt farmers, some fur farmers, not farmers, fur hunters. And this is like all of the rabbits that they were able to kill in just a single day. Okay, so rabbits in just 40, 50 years, spread across nearly the entirety of Australia and basically grazed the habitat to nothing. There's almost no grass here, causing massive destruction of habitat and competition, of course, for farmers who are trying to grow cows. So in 1950, the CSIRO, the Australian Science Organization, introduced myxomatosis. Okay. Oh, before I start that, this is the rabbit-proof fence. There's a big fence going through Australia where they tried to stop rabbits from going past this fence. And you can see one side of the rabbit-proof fence and the other side of the rabbit-proof fence. This is the effect of rabbits. So they introduced myxomatosis in the 1950s, and you can see that when it was introduced, it was very virulent. Okay, so class 1 virulence is the most deadly, and so every rabbit that got myxomatosis died. Well, almost every rabbit. Okay, there's always some individuals that survive, and when individuals survive, they survive because they have some kind of built-in immunity or something that within them allows them to do so, and then when they reproduce, of course, that those genes become much more common in the population. And in just 3 years, the fertility rate of rabbits was much, much lower. So most of them were just class 3 fertility rate. Okay, so even though it was extremely successful in the first year, the fact that just a few individuals survived, so it moved down into here, so this is where it started, very virulent, and lots of animals, and then the population dropped, but it caused the virulence to go down, and so as a result of that, the population could rebound. And you can see this here, this is the plague years of rabbits, lots and lots of rabbits. They introduced myxomatosis, population crashed, stayed low for a few years, and then basically rabbits become immune to myxomatosis, and the population spikes again. This process was repeated. They introduced rabbit fleas, same thing, and then the rabbits become immune to that. And they introduced another one in the late 90s, and now the populations of rabbits are rebounding from that. Interestingly, myxomatosis then spread back into other countries. So in the UK, the Brits were very upset because most of the rabbits went extinct as a result of what was going on in Australia. But of course, over time, the populations rebounded in exactly the same way, and in France as well. So here we have replicated evidence across three different parts of the world of this sort of response by rabbits to the virulence of myxomatosis. Okay, so the key to any host parasite system is that there's a relationship between transmission and virulence. Okay, so if a parasite increases in virulence with transmission, or if transmission increases with virulence, so for example, in many trout, for example, they have a fly, a worm that goes into their brains and makes them much more easy to catch. And so this is basically deadly, and what this does is it basically drives the species towards extinction. If you have a completely negative relationship between the two, so if you have high virulence, you have no transmission, low virulence, you have high transmission, then effectively this disease or this host or parasite, sorry, this parasite or disease will do nothing. And but for most cases, you have this sort of hump shape, which is the fact that basically the virulence of the parasite is able to adapt depending on the host transmissibility. So it's not deadly, but it basically is maintained in the population. So for example, the common flu is like this. And there's a thought experiment for you as you're studying for the exam. And the thought experiment is to consider the difference in the trade-offs between an animal that creates poisonous chemicals versus a parasite, and how does the trade-off for the organism happen? Okay, I want to move on. Okay, so how do we test for coevolution in something like a host parasite system? So one way we can do this is to also look at the genetic structure of the host and the genetic structure, or the evolutionary lineage structure of the host and of the parasite. Okay, so what happens, the idea is that because parasites are typically specialized on hosts, if you get speciation occurring among the host species, for example, in pigeons, you have a host that splits into pigeon species that splits into two or three different species. What you should observe is that the parasites that specialize on them also become speciated, and that the sort of phylogenetic trees of these two lineages should largely match. Okay, so that when this species became first split into two species here, then the parasites that were on the different types of those new hosts then also split into different species. Okay, and we see this as an example for pigeons. This is the actual data from pigeons, and looks a little bit like this. Okay, so these are the feather lice, and this is the pigeon species. And you can see there's a very close match between many of them. Okay, there's some jumping around, but overall it matches very closely. So this is another method we can test for coevolution by looking at the sort of evolutionary history of the two sets of organisms. Okay, we have the same with mammals, so the quality of this picture is really crap. Okay, now probably the most well-known, I don't know how many of you have come across this, but probably the most well-known case of parasites is what we call brood parasites. So if you go into any forest around here at the moment, you are likely to hear cuckoos calling. Cuckoos are brood parasites. What they do, this is an adult cuckoo, what they do is that they lay their eggs in the nest of other species and let those other species raise their young for them. Okay, so this is a reed warbler, which is a really common host of these of cuckoo chicks. And this reed warbler is having to pay all of the cost of raising this giant cuckoo chick. So of course, raising such a big chick for the reed warbler is very expensive. And so this is what drives the evolution. Okay, so for a cuckoo, the best thing would be for all of the nests that it lays an egg into for those chicks, for those parents to raise their chicks for them. But if they do that, then this chick basically doesn't get any of its own. So this adult doesn't get any of its own chicks, and so this drives selection for those adults to somehow avoid being parasitized. And there's a nice video here that I'll show you that explains how the chicks of the cuckoos can basically maximize their probability of being the one that is raised by ejecting the eggs of their host. Let's see if this works.
Unseen by the reed warbler, dropped her egg into this nest. Now the young cuckoo hatches. As the first of the brood, the reed warbler did not notice the trick, but now feeds the young as if it were its own. The young cuckoo needs to throw the other eggs out of the nest. If it doesn't do this, then the parents will not be able to feed all the nestlings.
So this happens for a little while. This is a pretty amazing adaptation for this chick to have some kind of genetic signal in its brain to tell it to do this behavior. So it just shows the strength of evolution that happens through co-evolutionary dynamics. Okay, so the adaptation of the parasite here is to remove the eggs of potential competitors from the nest in order for the chick of the parasite to basically get all of the food and all of the parent's attention. I'll note that it can also eject the chicks of, as well as just the eggs. Okay, so in response, of course, this is massive selection against the host. So these reed warblers, tiny little bird, gets no reproductive success if a cuckoo lays its egg, an egg in its nest. And so they've responded by developing egg recognition. So they can recognize a cuckoo egg relative to their own egg. Okay, so these are a bunch of experiments. They gave control eggs and different types of eggs, and they show that if the egg is really different to the reed warbler nest, reed warbler egg, then it almost always gets rejected by the host. Yes, of course, now this is selection against cuckoos. So cuckoos want to avoid this because they want their egg to stay in the nest. And so they've basically developed egg copying. And one of the really fascinating examples of this is in prunias and cisticolas that are parasitized by cuckoo finches. And you can see that these prunias have developed lots of different egg signatures. So this is all the same species, but individuals develop different types of eggs, and cuckoo finches lay eggs that match the eggs of the nest in which they're laying the egg. Okay? Pretty amazing. Of course, now this drives selection, of course, for the host to become even better at recognizing their eggs, and there's some evidence that they actually have individual signatures. So if you look at where the spots are, that each host, each reed warbler, for example, will have its own signature of where all the dots are, and so you can recognize that, making it's much more difficult for the cuckoo to respond to that. Okay, so we can see that this is an escalation of adaptations, and that the parasite first increases virulence, so it rejects all of the eggs of the host. And the host then responds by becoming better at detecting the parasite. It detects which eggs are not theirs. The parasites improve their ability to remain cryptic by having similar eggs to the host, and the host develops better detection mechanisms. So you can see how this is an escalating process and so on. So there's also a whole bunch of other traits where this has happened. So for example, the developmental periods, cuckoos develop much faster than the reed warblers, and mimicries as well. So they have these barred chests which mimic predators. So the aim of that is to scare away the host from the nest so that they have time to go and lay the egg and so on. Here we can look similar thing with plant pollinators. This is a sword-billed hummingbird, a crazy adaptation. It has this really long bill, and this bill is so long and so heavy, for example, that a sword-billed hummingbird, it can't even keep its head flat. It always has to sort of keep its head upright, balancing its bill. And this is because it feeds on a bunch of plants that have evolved to basically put their nectar as far deep into the plant in order to maximize the probability that the pollinator will get some pollen onto it. Okay, so plants want to maximize the amount of pollen that's transferred onto the pollinator, and birds and insects want to maximize the amount of nectar. And so plants develop strategies, so they have these long tubes, so they're hiding the nectar in the bottom and forcing the predator to go digging deep as possible so that they can place the pollen onto the pollinator. Okay, so this is a sort of pictorial version of that. It might start something like this, with the pollinators getting the nectar, but of course the pollinator doesn't want to spend much time or effort getting that nectar because it wants to move on to the next plant, and so the plant makes it a little bit more difficult, so it has to go digging, and so on, and you get this evolution of this very long thing. Okay, and in this sort of system, of course, you also get cheats, these mimics. So for example, these are a bunch of plants that these hummingbird hawk moths forage on. They have these long proboscis, and then you get orchids that mimic this. So this one almost perfectly mimics the shape of the proboscis, but it provides no nectar whatsoever. It's just fooling the pollinator, forcing the pollinator to come and grab its pollen without giving it a reward. Okay, so this plant doesn't want to pay the cost of producing the nectar. And so you get a whole, similar to the Bayesian mimicry, you get a whole sort of system of frequencies of models and mimics and pollinators and the whole dynamics of that. Okay, the last thing I just want to talk just a few more minutes is about mutualisms. Okay, so so far I've talked about arms races, I've talked about species that basically cause a cost at another species. You also get other situations in which rather than a negative-negative competition or predation, you get a positive-positive interaction. Okay, one species provides a service that is beneficial for the other species that returns a service. Okay, so it's like what we call symbiosis and so on. It's a close ecological interdependent relationship between two species. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of these. You might be familiar, for example, corals are symbiotes. Bacteria, nitrogen-fixing bacteria, so they provide food for other plants in the soil, and so on. What I'm going to talk about today, just give you an example of ant-acacia mutualism. Okay, so across South America and Africa, what you have is you have these acacias, and these acacias over time have developed spines in order to avoid herbivores browsing them. Okay, so a major cost for a tree, as we saw with the elk, is that big browsers, so in Africa you have lots of antelope, you have elephants, giraffes, and so on. It's very costly for the plant, and so the plants develop spines, but those spines are no longer that effective. Okay, so it's quite amazing to watch. I work in Africa, I see this quite a bit. You see elephants, and they will just rip all the bark off one of these things. If I try to touch one of those spines, it goes all the way straight through my hand. They're incredibly sharp and incredibly stiff. Okay, so an alternative strategy, what some of these acacias have evolved, is they're basically providing housing and food for ants in order to be colonized by ants so that those ants can then ward off the herbivores. Okay, so this is a gall. This is a sort of inflamed base of this spine. And this thing is kind of porous inside. So it's a hard shell. It's porous inside and it's perfect environment for ants to make a home, and so they're inviting the ants to make this home. Okay, so the plant is providing habitat, and some plants also provide a bit of food. They provide some protein for the ants so that the ants stay present on the plant, and in return what they get by the ant is basically 24-hour protection against herbivores. If a herbivore comes and starts chewing on that plant, then the ants release their pheromone and they all attack and sting the herbivore, which is very unpleasant. But they ask you to do a little bit more than that. It's been shown that they will go and clear the seeds and saplings of other plants around, so it reduces the competition for the host plant. So the third sort of method that we can talk about is how we can test for coevolution is using experiments. Okay, so we can experimentally try and remove a symbiote. So Dan Jensen, a researcher in the 1960s, he went, this was in Costa Rica, and he fumigated a whole bunch of acacias to remove the ants. He also put some goo around the base of the ants to prevent ants from recolonizing. So he had two treatments. One is plants without ants, one is plants with ants, and he monitored the growth, regrowth, and so on, of the different types of plants, of the different treatments. And just briefly, what he found is quite striking differences. So he had 66 in the treatment, so where he'd removed the ants, and 72 in the occupied. If you look at the sort of amount of growth alone, in these unoccupied ones, they had, you know, about 2.4 kilos or 2.9 kilos of growth on average, but the ones that had ants had on average 41 kilos of growth in the same amount of time. Okay, so by preventing from herbivores from coming and eating all of the regrowth, the ones that had ants were able, the plant was able to grow much healthier. So basically what this means is that instead of paying the cost of growing and losing part of itself, okay, to herbivores, it's instead invested a little bit of cost into providing habitat and food for ants, and in return, it gets a much larger amount of growth. Okay, so this, at the end of the day, this all comes down to a cost-benefit trade-off. It's less costly for the plant to provide habitat and food for ants, in relative to the rewards that it gets, which is it's able to keep a lot of its growth. Okay, so this is just a summary of that. And so just in total summary, coevolution can occur among different types of relationships, both positive and negative. We saw the lots of negative ones, about offensive behaviors and defensive traits, and also symbiosis. And just briefly, this is a table that you might be interested in. Of course, if you think about parasites, if a parasite kills a host, and in a way it's like a predator. So why do we call things parasites and why do we call some other things predators? Well, it's largely just a definitional thing related to the body size. So parasites have much smaller body size than hosts, and predators are typically larger than their hosts. And that's it. Okay, thank you.